the Learning Link. She didn't know who to report this to, but the phone company's business office gave her Kaiser's name and security. She tells him what happened and asks Kaiser to trace the calls. She wonders why anyone would do something like this. Kaiser desperately wants to say, "My God, what a coincidence. I was just about to call you." But he can't, of course, because he can't compromise the confidentiality of his investigation. All he can do is listen to her story and then, at the end of it, say gently, "I know someone you can call." He gives her the phone number of Secret Service headquarters. The Secret Service is very cooperative. Someone gets all the details of the crash and tells the woman the agency will investigate. And that's how the Learning Link crash would become the pivotal event in the case that the federal government was slowly building against the boys in MOD. Were it not for this confluence, the Learning Link incident might never have been singled out. But as it happened, the system crash was something that law enforcement could understand immediately. It was not as ephemeral as trying to grasp the definition of a switch. It was concrete. The system had been working. The system was now crashed. An organized gang of hackers did it. It was just the event to catapult the MOD case to the top of the pile in the Secret Service's telecommunications division. Secret Service agents started having frequent conversations with prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office. They made plans to execute search warrants at the hackers' houses. The Learning Link crash was, in fact, the event that 4 years later would cause a prosecutor to smile wryly as he explained, "This made the case sexy." Even though Eli's missive to the media never got delivered, the general message was getting through. Hackers are out there, people, and we'd better figure out who they are and what they're doing. The Learning Link affair was remaining a secret for now, but thanks to the Morris story, newspapers and news magazines are assigning reporters to learn the new definition of the word hacker. In that spirit, Harper's Magazine decided to host an electronic forum on the topic of, "Is computer hacking a crime?" The forum took place in cyberspace itself, during an 11-day period in December. The gathering place, the little corner of the electronic world where the forum rambled like a never-ending cocktail party, is called the Whole Earth Electronic Link, better known as the Well. The San Francisco Bay Area-based commercial bulletin board system is a seminal outpost that attracts some of the best minds of the communication revolution. On the Well, an explosive mixture of computers and communications was being brewed. About 40 guests log in from their homes and participate in an open-ended freewheeling debate. They were an eclectic group, and among them were Eli and Mark, uninvited, and a retired cattle rancher and lyricist for the Grateful Dead, John Perry Barlow. Given the amount of time they spent there, it was bound to happen that the boys and Barlow would cross paths online one day. But who could have imagined the repercussions? John Perry Barlow tells everyone he lives in Pinedale, Wyoming. But that's not really true. He actually lives in a much more isolated place, a place called Cora, population 4. Cora makes Pinedale look like Los Angeles. Barlow's grandfather founded Sublette County and built a cattle ranch next to 15,000 acres of Forest Service land. Barlow's great-granduncle was the first white man to winter on the upper headwaters of the Wind River. Barlow went east, well, east to Colorado, to prep school, where he was schoolmates with future Grateful Dead band member Bob Weir. After Wesleyan College and a stint in New York City working on a never-published novel, Barlow wrote songs for the Dead before meandering home to the Crossbar Ranch. That's minus plus, if you're braining calves. And as Barlow says, they sure got the minus sign in the right place. Barlow traveled many trails in his youth, and by the mid-1980s, with the ranch's fortunes in decline, he needed another way to make a living. He turned to the thing he knew best, writing. He bought a computer, a compact 30-pound luggable, mainly because he figured it would be easier to use than a typewriter. A better whiteout. But in 1987, Barlow learned his computer was good for something else. That was the year he discovered that the futuristic place described by science fiction writer William Gibson as cyberspace was in fact here. A friend, a fellow deadhead, convinced Barlow to buy a modem and log into the Well to communicate with other dead fans. Right away, Barlow saw the similarities between this new electronic community and the small towns of his youth. Small towns were disappearing, but new ones, a generation of computer-connected villages, were replacing them. And the beauty of it was, just like in small-town life, everyone knew everyone else there. People worked together, shared information, and pooled their knowledge, creating a vast collective consciousness. It was a primitive settlement. People were still learning how to communicate. There were no rules or laws yet. Instead of physical possessions, all people carried was knowledge, which they shared. Barlow moved in and started writing about it. By now, 2 years later, Barlow was spending so many hours a week on the well that he was a beloved Net personality. So it was no surprise that he was asked to participate in the Harper's Forum. There, Barlow met two gatecrashers, hackers who showed up uninvited and who called themselves Acid Freak and Fiber Optic. When they logged into the forum in the early evening of day one, the conversation's tenor shifted radically. Gone was the high-minded, theoretical discussion about the rights of privacy versus the right to explore. In its place appeared a challenge born of fluctuating hormones and adolescent invincibility. Acid Freak. There is no hacker ethic. The hacker of old sought to find what the computer itself could do. There was nothing illegal about it. Today, hackers and freaks are drawn to specific, often corporate systems. It's no wonder everyone on the other side is getting mad. We're always one step ahead. Even as he typed, Eli was defining himself, creating his own new hacker ethic. It was a philosophy in which exploration for the sake of discovery is its own justification. And it was also a philosophy in which he saw himself as the baddest gunslinger to ever ride into town. But no hint of that teenage transformation got conveyed to the rest of the law-fearing, job-holding adult participants. They didn't even know who this Acid Freak character was. They certainly had no way of knowing he was just a teenager with a poster of a bikini-clad model on the closet door in his bedroom. They didn't know that it had been a blind kid named Carlos who lived across the street who taught Eli the ABCs of phone freaking. Carlos's mom was from Argentina, and Eli's mom was from Costa Rica, and the two were friends. So it was only natural that Eli and Carlos would be friends too. Carlos even had a computer, which of course he couldn't see. Later, Eli got his own computer and learned enough to turn the payphone down the block on Parsons Boulevard into a free phone. It was a kick to walk by the phone and see a line of people waiting to call home to Columbia. And he'd think of Carlos and how much a guy could do if he put his mind to it. Of course, all the forum participants really needed to know was that Harper's Forum on Hackers had flushed the elusive species from the bushes. Barlow himself could well remember his own trespasses, including a late-night climb over a government defense installation's fence, in finding himself infatuated by the impulses of Acid Freak and Fiber Optic. He was not alone. Within hours, the forum's participants had declared their fascination with Acid Freak and Fiber Optic, and by the afternoon of day six, the two hackers had become celebrities. Even their most outrageous adolescent crowing and foomfetting was getting careful consideration. This emboldened Eli, who espoused the view that any computer system vulnerable to hackers was fair game. It was the system administrator's fault if the computer got hacked. It was the administrator's responsibility to keep it secure, after all. If he was too dumb to do that, then hackers had the right to trespass. It was the old I-center argument again. Did Eli really believe that? Once this philosophy was posted on the well, he couldn't take it back. It became his position. In a matter of weeks, it was going to be printed in Harper's, and then every subscriber in the country would read it. One participant questioned Eli's assertions, posting that computer networks are built on trust. If they aren't, they should be. Acid Freak. Yeah, sure. And we should use the honor system as the first line of security against hack attempts. This cocksure disregard for honor and honesty struck a chord with the very hacker-gawking adults that Eli had charmed earlier. As Barlow later wrote, presented with such a terrifying amalgam of raw youth and apparent power, we fluttered like a flock of indignant babbits around the status quo, defending it heartily. One participant, a former hacker named Jeff Poskanzer, shot back this sarcastic reply. Jeff Poskanzer, this guy down the street from me sometimes leaves his back door unlocked. If I had the chance to do it over, I would go in the back door, shoot him, and take all his money and consumer electronics. That is the only way to get through to him. Acid Freak. Jeff Poskanker? Puss? Canker? Yuck. Anyway, now when did you first start having these delusions where computer hacking was even remotely similar to murder? Before publication, Harper's edited the conversation, deleting Eli's name-calling and thereby denying readers a glimpse of the adolescent hiding behind the fearsome nickname. In fact, editing eliminated any flagrantly immature statement that Eli made, rendering him a larger-than-life electronic desperado. It's a one-dimensional portrait, but one that he will find hard to resist in the coming months. The media and the monster. Which is the creation and which the creator? The forum participants bristled at the bad boy attitude Eli sported. Barlow. Acid, my house is at 372 North Franklin Street in Pinedale, Wyoming. Heading north on Franklin, go about two blocks off the main drag before you run into a hay meadow on the left. on the last house before the field. The computer is always on. You disappoint me, pal. For all your James Dean on Silicon rhetoric, you're not a cyberpunk. You're just a punk. Acid freak. Mr. Barlow, thank you for posting all I need to get your credit information and a whole lot more. Now who is to blame? Me for getting it, or you for being such an idiot? The language was heated now, and in cyberspace, the words themselves are all you have to guide you. The words aren't tempered by inflection, or by a wry smile that says you're really just kidding, or by body language that says you're more amused than enraged. No, the words are the whole communication, and they sure could look stark on your computer screen. On day 10, Barlow was writing what can only be called fighting words. Barlow, let me define my terms, using hacker in a mid-spectrum sense, with Cracker on one end and Leonardo da Vinci on the other. I think it does take a kind of genius to be a truly productive hacker. With crackers like Acid and Optic, the issue is less intelligence than alienation. Trade their modems for skateboards, and only a slight conceptual shift would occur. Until now, Mark had read more than he'd written, leaving the boasting to Eli, but now he was incensed. He couldn't take it anymore. And so the gunslinger, the fastest two fingers in the East, typed this fateful response at 10:11 p.m. on the evening of the 10th day. Fiber optic. You have some pair of balls. This was indeed boring, but nonetheless. And then he did it. He rendered this rhetorical discussion absolutely real. Mark posted a copy of Barlow's private credit report, culled from TRW, right smack in the middle of the forum for all the participants to read. Barlow, sitting at his office in Cora, Post Office Pinedale, watched the intimate details of his finances appear before him on the screen, no matter that the snippet from TRW was abbreviated and incorrect, no matter that reading credit histories and then copying the files into his own computer was far different from actually having the ability to alter a report. No, none of that mattered, for Mark had just demonstrated that some hackers have very real power over the lives of everyday people. Barlow wondered what life in America would be like without credit. As Barlow later wrote, I've been in redneck bars wearing shoulder-length curls, police custody while on acid, and Harlem after midnight, and no one has ever put the spook in me quite as Fiber Optic did at that moment. Barlow asked Fiber Optic to call him. Of course, Mark did, and there, well beyond the spotlight of the electronic forum, the two met, man to man, on the phone, the romantic and the outlaw. Barlow came to see Mark as a pencil-necked kid with the same desire to violate the forbidden that had motivated male adolescents since the dawn of testosterone. The phone conversation burgeoned into a telephonic friendship, and Barlow came to believe Mark is surprisingly principled, with impulses that are purely exploratory. Mark is Mark, and in explaining his philosophy, that of a lone scientist in his laboratory, he never saw the need to fill Barlow in on the less savory aspects of MOD's adventures. Whatever Eli or other MOD members did to the Learning Link, they did on their own, without Mark's help or commiseration or even knowledge. Mark was articulate. Mark was earnest. And Mark was nothing if not persuasive. Mark would make a good poster boy for any group that decided to carve out specific civil liberties for hackers in cyberspace. Barlow wasn't thinking about all these things, not yet at least, when he had his first phone conversation with Mark. The rest would come later. For now, Barlow began to wonder if we wouldn't also regard spelunkers as desperate criminals if AT&T owned all the caves. 8. January 15th, 1990 seems like just another routine day. On the day that AT&T's system will catastrophically fail, Tom Kaiser commutes on the Long Island Railroad into Manhattan. While he tries to read the paper, he feels the usual early morning anxiety that comes from not knowing what the hackers were doing the night before. When he arrives at his office about 8:30, he immediately checks on the black box. The DNRs show the hackers had a busy night, but nothing appears out of the ordinary. Cat and mouse. But isn't the cat supposed to win? He updates Staples, who moved back to his own office after the strike ended, on the previous evening's hacking activities. On the phone, they go over it together, and nothing they notice, nothing they talk about, sends an alarm through their heads. Nothing on the DNRs causes either of them to say, "Oh my God," pick up the phone, and call the authorities. By mid-afternoon, however, it is clear that today will be different. Kaiser hears the news first on the radio. AT&T has crashed. Journalists are speculating about the damage. Will the crash spill over to affect other crucial services? Will telephone transmissions at airports be blocked? How long will AT&T customers be cut off from communicating with relatives, aging parents, for instance, in other parts of the country? Meanwhile, hundreds of customers are calling AT&T, demanding an explanation. Hundreds more call New York Telephone, unaware that the local phone company has nothing to do with the long-distance glitches. The average customer doesn't understand and doesn't care about the early 1980s divestiture that separated AT&T from the local phone companies. To the average customer, the only truth is this. If a phone call isn't going through, then the phone company is to blame. Simple. Now fix it. At his battered metal desk, Kaiser listens to the news and all he can think is, did the hackers do this? And worse, he thinks, did we let this happen? Almost every day for months, Kaiser and Staples have played the what-if game. What if a hacker makes a mistake and crashes the computer? What if a hacker deliberately sabotages the computer? What if? Every workday has been a game of Russian roulette for the New York Telephone investigators. The hacker's gun is loaded with bullets, and every day the investigators have wondered if he'd shoot one into the brain of the phone company. And now, AT&T is down. It could be mere happenstance that the nation's first long-distance phone crash was occurring right in the middle of Kaiser and Staples' biggest computer intrusion investigation ever. It could be one of those coincidences that dog Kaiser, but he doesn't like the odds. Within moments, he and Staples are on the phone again, hashing out possibilities, figuring out what to do next. The hackers haven't done anything obvious, Kaiser says, looking at the DNR menu on his computer screen. He scrolls slowly through each of the phone numbers that the hackers dialed in the past 24 hours. The initial news reports say AT&T has code problems, says Staples. They both know that doesn't let the hackers off the hook. Code problems is a simple way of saying there's some internal snag in the AT&T operating system, some bug that may have been introduced into the millions of lines of computer code that run the Mammoth Network. It's the equivalent of saying that somewhere in the world, in one copy of the Bible, it says Jesus. How do you find the word in the one line, in one page, in one copy of the book? For AT&T technicians, the awesome task ahead would be to isolate the affected area of the code. Find the bug. Maybe there's a misplaced command. Maybe somebody forgot to hit the return key when typing a line. Maybe it was just a few incorrect keystrokes that upset the delicate balance of the entire operating system. Of course, if the whole phone system crash was caused by a bug, that raises another question. How did the bug get into the code in the first place? If it was deliberate, then it was malicious. That could point to hackers. If it was a mistake, then it still could point to hackers, because a bunch of kids were fooling around in the system, who knows what they might type in ignorance. Even if no obvious connection pops onto Kaiser's screen as he scrolls through the DNR list, he has to wonder. Maybe the crash was precipitated by a hacker or hackers that Kaiser doesn't even know about. He's long suspected that there might be others in the phone company computers, wilier intruders who covered their tracks so well that Kaiser never suspected their presence. And what about all the phone numbers that Kaiser's hackers call from their home phones? Could one of those numbers connect the hackers to a ringleader? Some mysterious and dangerous instigator whom Kaiser doesn't even know about? You could what-if yourself to death in some jobs. And Kaiser has one of those jobs. Did we make a mistake? Kaiser asks Staples. Did we make the right call in which hackers to follow? Or is there someone out there who's more important and we aren't following them? But they could indulge in only so much self-flagellation. It hadn't been their idea to drag out this case for so many months. After all, they've already turned over enough information from the DNRs to enable the prosecutor to apply for search warrants at the hackers' houses. They even passed along the tip about the learning link to the Secret Service. It was up to the government now to get the search warrants. The Secret Service and the U.S. Attorney's Office kept telling Kaiser that it was in the works. Any day now, they'd say. At Secret Service headquarters downtown, a certain special agent named Rick Harris was torturing himself with the same questions that were hounding Kaiser and Staples. Harris ran the new telecommunications division in the agency's Manhattan field office. By virtue of that title, he'd been monitoring this case for months, getting regular updates from the agent in charge of the case. Despite the impatience of Kaiser and Staples, the Secret Service had been working steadily on this case. It was an opportunity for the agency to set a precedent in a new area of investigation. You see, the Secret Service had been slowly investigating more and more computer crime cases. Ever since a new federal law in the mid-1980s had given the Secret Service authority to investigate credit card fraud, among other crimes, the agency had been gearing up for the electronic era in crime. Credit card fraud was a natural digression for the Secret Service. The agency is the law enforcement arm of the Treasury Department, after all. More and more credit card fraud was being perpetrated in cyberspace. You didn't have to be Bill Gates to know how to use your computer to log into an underground bulletin board and find lists of purloined long-distance calling card numbers you can use. Of course, in that instance, you'd also be using the telephone lines to commit a crime. Computers, telephone lines, whose jurisdiction was this? It gets complicated out there on the cutting edge of electronic crime. And that was why the Secret Service established a telecommunications division in its Manhattan office in 1989. The division, under the leadership of Harris, was supposed to figure out exactly what electronic crimes were occurring and how, and most important, how to fight back. This was a high-profile assignment for an agent still in his 30s. Harris, who has likable, laughing eyes and the easy shamble of a sheepdog shaking off sleep, believed from the very beginning that this area of law enforcement was on the verge of exploding. His first cases showed him just how pervasive electronic crime had become. The agency was in the middle of investigating several cases involving call cell operations. A call cell is, simply, a situation where someone illegally sells use of a phone to someone else. You see it all the time in New York City. Long lines at a street corner with recent immigrants waiting their turns to call home to the Dominican Republic or Colombia for $5. Here's how a call cell operation is set up. First, the mastermind breaks into a PBX. That's a private branch exchange computer that manages phone calls internally for big corporations. A PBX is just like a mini switch, handling all the phone traffic in and out of the corporation's offices. By hacking a PBX, an intruder can get control of the system and then dial out on one of the organization's phone lines to anywhere in the world. In the freewheeling experience of New York City, where 85% of all PBX fraud occurs, street entrepreneurs advertise the availability of $5 phone calls. $5 to call for half an hour to your cousins in Bangladesh is a bargain. Although Harris had become familiar with the intricacies of call cell fraud, Kaiser's hacker case had been his first glimpse of a whole new kind of crime. Harris had been watching, amazed, for months as the evidence accumulated that unknown hackers were climbing around in every sensitive phone company computer that existed. He knew the implications as well as Kaiser. He knew the extent of the harm these hackers were capable of doing. He worried now that he was witnessing an explosion. In the mid-afternoon, Harris phones AT&T. He calls the long-distance carrier's operations center in New Jersey. That's where the big maps glow red, and top officials are tearing out their hair. Harris explains his concern, and then volunteers to help investigate the crash. A beleaguered AT&T official says, "We'll get back to you." Don't wait for someone from AT&T to get back to you. It's better to answer the question now, to know as soon as possible if the AT&T crash is related to the hacker case. Harris immediately dials again. Kaiser answers. "Tom, we need to know every single number the hackers have dialed in the hours preceding the crash," Harris says. Of course, Kaiser and Staples already know every single number. They've been staring at every single one so long that they start to feel hypnotized by the damn numbers. The more difficult task is to figure out if any of the numbers the hackers dialed is a clue to what caused the crash. Staples comes down to Kaiser's office, where they print out the list from the electronic DNR. It's easier to read that way. Then they go over the list yet again, this time checking off each phone number as they eliminate it. Here's a call from one hacker to another. Check it off. Here's a call to New York Telephone. Check it off. By late afternoon, Kaiser and Staples are finished. They are relieved. They pass along the news to the Secret Service. "There's nothing here that would have caused any particular jeopardy," Staples concludes, "at least not within the last 24 hours. And by evening, AT&T was taking the blame for the crash, announcing that internal system problems caused the failure. That was another relief, because it meant that nobody seriously believes that the hackers did the damage. It turned out that the failure could be traced to a routine update of AT&T software. 3 weeks earlier, software that controls 114 super switches nationwide was changed, ironically, to improve the reliability of the system. A minor problem had developed first within the Broadway 51, a switch in Manhattan that was trying to obey the buggy lines of code that had been loaded into it 3 weeks earlier. The switch shut down to reset, just as it was supposed to do whenever it swallows a bug, putting its calls on hold for up to 6 seconds during the reset process. But in the meantime, a second computer developed a similar problem, and then a third. And then before you knew it, several switches were shutting down to reset, diverting their calls elsewhere to other computers that couldn't handle the load. So the backup switches got caught in the reset loop too. By 7 p.m., AT&T had figured out how to patch the system to avoid the bugs in the code that set off the reaction. The system recovered. In Manhattan, at New York Telephone headquarters, Kaiser and Staples recovered from their anxieties. And in Secret Service headquarters, Rick Harris recovers from his worries. But the events of the day have made him uneasy all the same. What if? Nearly 2 weeks later, Mark stands outside a little neighborhood grocery store on Corona Avenue. In the dark and the cold, he hangs out with a group of guys from his block. Everybody's smoking and talking, interrupting their evening walks from the subway to supper. Mark puffs a mentholated 100, as usual. He feels pretty good. He's no longer fretting over the AT&T crash and no longer worries that hackers caused it. His only worry right now is the cramp in his right foot. He flexes, trying to work it out.
So it catches Mark by surprise when someone in the group,
a kid who lives next door to the Abeans, says, "Something strange is going on over at your house."
"What do you mean?" asks Mark.
"A bunch of men are going in and out of his house, carrying boxes out to cars. They've been there for a while. No one else has gone in or out. A lot of neighbors have noticed. It's kind of weird." "One of them told my dad to move his Jeep," the kid says. Mark forgets the cramp. He stubs out his cigarette and heads off towards home, not exactly running, but moving as fast as you can without running. It's a one-block walk, but it takes him from one ecosystem to another. He turns the corner, hustling from the tropical-colored storefronts and strings of flashing lights of Corona to the frosty darkness of Alstein Avenue's row houses. He passes by the place in the street where many summers ago a long-lost teenage gang, the Alstein Avenue Boys, carved initials in the hot tar to claim their turf. Mark is really nervous now. He always feels stressed first in his stomach and is churning now. Who could be at his house? He can see the house now, but Mark doesn't see anyone outside. He's breathing a little hard from the hustle, and he wonders fleetingly if the kid was putting him on. He's filled with a moment of hot relief, but then he's suddenly seized by an even stronger feeling. Dread. Mark skitters up the stoop to the front door with the three colored panes of glass. In one pane, his mother has taped a picture of the Virgin Mary. As soon as the door closes behind him, Mark hears knocking. Someone's out on the stoop. He opens it, and a tall stranger wearing a three-quarter-length tan quilted jacket blocks the entryway. Mark is scared. In fact, he's freaking out. The man says his name is Agent Russo. He says he's from the Secret Service. All Mark can think about is how cheap his jacket looks. It's an odd thought, totally inappropriate to the moment, but it's the one idea that Mark's mind consciously reaches out to grab as a million other urgent images fly past. It's the thought Mark uses to divert himself from the terrible truth of what's happening in his house. He's being raided. No, actually, it's a hacker named Fiber Optic who is being raided. But wait, no, it's not just Fiber Optic taking the fall. Mark Abeen, age 17, a junior in high school, avid reader of the book Gnomes, as well as the circuitry repair tips of Forrest P. Mims III, enthusiastic intern at the Queen's Hall of Science, is being raided by the Secret Service. Mark lets Russo enter the house. Other agents appear in the living room. Mark figures there must be nearly a dozen of them, all wearing those dark blue windbreakers you see on TV cop shows, jackets that say U.S. Secret Service on the back. Mark sees the holsters under their jackets. It's an incongruous sight. All these big, gruff agents filling the narrow, dark space of Mark's mustard-colored living room. Everything looks just the way it did when he left for school this morning, but now it's hostile territory, invaded by an occupying army. Navy blue sofa, dining room table, swathed in a clear plastic cover. The coffee table books about Dom DeLuise and Marilyn Monroe. His dad's jazz records stacked so neatly. His mother's shiny black boots lined up on an old newsday by the front door. Soon the agents tell Mark all his computer stuff has been packed up and removed from his bedroom. "The room is so empty you can paint the walls," one agent says. From somewhere, Mark's mother and father appear. They seem to be floating in the doorway, floating into and out of Mark's vision, as if they were next to the mirror at the Hall of Science. An agent tells them, "Your son has caused billions of dollars worth of damage." The agent is referring to the AT&T crash. "Wait a minute. All the agents seem to think Mark is responsible. There's been some mistake. It was all just a software bug." Mark can't scream it out. He finds himself unable to speak at all. Everyone sits down at the dining room table, Mark at the head. For some reason, all he can do is focus on each intruder, taking a mental snapshot of each face around the table. One weather-beaten old guy with a gray mustache in an Australian cowboy hat with one side of the brim turned up. Two men from New York Telephone Security including one so old he had to put on glasses to read. Agent Russo, thin with plain brown hair and a bald face. One of them says to Mark, "I'm from Belcor in Piscataway." A Secret Service agent says, "Pumpkin Pete says hi." This false statement has the desired effect of making Mark think that his friend ratted him out. Mark is starting to feel paranoid. But can you just be paranoid if the thing you're paranoid about is really, truly, absolutely happening right in front of you in the dining room before supper? It's all happening really fast. An agent says, "We want to ask you some questions." They would like Mark to come back to Manhattan headquarters with them, though he is not under arrest. Mark's parents finally get angry. They say no. Mark's parents tell the agents to leave. Then they look at Mark. The agents look at Mark. The Belcor guy looks at Mark. The New York telephone security guys look at Mark. Everybody wants Mark to speak, to say something. Finally, they leave, funneling out into the chill January night. And Mark has never said a word. 30 miles to the east, a car pulls up to a lighted security booth at the entrance of Polytechnic University on Long Island. The driver asks for directions to the dormitory. 5 minutes later, Paul Styra hears a knock on the door of room 4B, the dorm suite he shares with three other students. It is around 6 o'clock, and the roommates have just finished cooking dinner. Paul opens the door and sees the director of student life standing in the cluttered hallway, looking stricken and flanked by three burly men dressed in business suits. One of them has his jacket off and wears a holster and gun. Paul is scared, but he's not showing it. His face is blank. If you went just by his expression, you could just as easily believe Paul was watching a TV rerun as being raided by the Secret Service. Inside, Paul's roiling, but it sure won't help to let the Secret Service know that. One of the men introduces himself as Special Agent Jeff Gavin of the Secret Service. Gavin looks over Paul's shoulder into the common living room with the brown couch and his gawking roommate. Gavin asks Paul if there's some place private to talk. Paul typically is noncommittal. Gavin finally asks the roommate to leave. What happens next is in dispute. The way Paul remembers it, Gavin comes down on him like a tough guy, tells him that his older brother, Tom Styra, has been arrested for credit card fraud that morning, and that Tom told us everything about Paul's hacking exploits. This is very confusing to Paul, because as far as he knows, his older brother has never been involved in any kind of fraud and doesn't know the first thing about computers. In fact, Tom Styra never was accused of any crime. Then Gavin waves a manila envelope around with the figures $70 million and $40 million written on it and says, "You're responsible for $110 million lost to the phone company." That would be the AT&T crash again. Doesn't the Secret Service believe AT&T's explanation? Gavin asks, "Are you Charles Styra?" "No," says Paul. "I'm Paul." Gavin remembers a very different version of the scene. He had not heard one thing about the hacker investigation until agents in the city called him in the Melville office at 5 p.m. They told him that New York City agents have already arrived at Paul's family house in Cambria Heights with a search warrant, only to find that their quarry and his computer were at college. Fearful that Paul would get wind of the visit before they could drive out there with a new search warrant to search Paul's dorm room, the agents called Gavin and asked for assistance. Gavin took notes on a manila envelope, he says, but he later lost the envelope. He doesn't remember what he wrote on the envelope, and he doesn't remember saying that Paul was responsible for $110 million in damage. Gavin says he doesn't remember telling Paul his brother had been arrested for credit card fraud. In one version of his story, you have a bully trying to intimidate a college student. In the other, you have a helpful federal agent introducing himself to Paul. The rest of the events are not in dispute. Gavin asks Paul for written permission to search his dorm room. He tells Paul that if he doesn't sign, then they'll all have to sit around together in the dorm room until a judge signs a search warrant. That could take hours. Paul asks if he can call his mom. Gavin says he'll go with Paul to the payphone in the hallway. He stands right next to Paul, even dials the call. Paul feels like a prisoner. His mom answers. "What have you done?" asks Jean Styra, who has hurried home from her job as a secretary at the Queens District Attorney's Office after learning that Secret Service agents were in her house. Now agents mill around her as she talks on the phone to Paul. "I don't know," says Paul. "It must be something with the computer. It must be something through bulletin boards or something they got my name from." "Cooperate and do what they say," she advises him. In Queens, agents are confiscating all kinds of stuff from the basement. They take Paul's dot matrix printer. They take a spare keyboard. They take his master modem and his Volksmodem, too. They take a fax machine and a Western Electric telephone. They take his Commodore 64 programmer's manual. But they don't stop there. They take a box of 14 cassette tapes, a baseball score sheet with various notes, and personal letters. They take something that they label Notes to Hack Canadian Ministry of Technology. The notes about hacking our neighbors to the north are actually notes that Paul jotted in 1985 while watching a fictional television program called Hide and Seek. And now, in his dorm room, Paul signs. Gavin hands him a one-page form titled Consent to Search, and Paul reads it over and scrawls his name at the bottom. Then Paul watches while one agent takes Polaroid photos and another carries away boxes full of his computer equipment. Out the door go the last vestiges of Paul's identity as Scorpion. His computer, 150 floppy disks, more modems, his connection wires. When they're finished, Gavin tells Paul that some agents from the New York City office will contact him shortly. In fact, they do. The very next day, they tell Paul that they left behind a printer, a joystick, and a mouse, and would it be okay to remove them? Paul says okay. It is nearly midnight, and Eli stands in the lobby of the Secret Service headquarters in the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. This is a building that in a few years would be the site of the worst terrorist bombing ever on American soil, but tonight the place is empty and quiet as a library. Eli is alone in the lobby. He waits. He admires a large plexiglass-covered display of U.S. currency and another that shows all the presidents. Until recently, these were the two major mandates of the Secret Service: protecting the currency from counterfeiters and protecting high-ranking officials. It's the former role that has evolved into fighting credit card fraud and computer crimes. How is it that of the three MOD boys that the Secret Service raided today, Eli is the one who finds himself standing in this antechamber waiting to confess? The scene when he'd arrived home from the movies at around 7 o'clock was chaotic. A tall man in a suit had come out of the house with a box. Eli said hi, and the man said, "Who are you?" "I'm Eli," he said. "Do you know who I am?" the man said. "Yeah, you have a badge around your neck." When Eli opened the door and walked in, a group of men he'd never seen before all yelled in unison, "Eli!" and it scared him. Eli stood in the dining room, near the doorway to his bedroom, and there he saw his mother, Maria, very upset. He greeted her in Spanish. She alternated between crying and digging out family photographs to show the Secret Service agents evidence that the Ladopoulos family had good friends in Costa Rica. One of the Secret Service agents said, "You're kidding. I was just guarding the president of Costa Rica." And Maria pulled from the buffet in the dining room a snapshot of the Costa Rican president himself. Her sister had worked for the Costa Rican embassy at the United Nations, and as a kid, Eli liked to go there and try on the headphones and listen to all the different languages. The way Eli remembers it, the agents told him he was in a lot of trouble and said that if he didn't come downtown with them right now to cooperate, it would look bad later on. The way Eli remembers it, one of the agents asked him if he was a communist. They asked him what his hacker alias was, and Eli told them, "Acid Freak. It's like a pen name." Now, several hours later, Eli still hasn't had dinner. He's waited for nearly an hour in this lobby, flopping on the couches, standing up again, pacing. Finally, Special Agent Martin Walsh comes out to escort Eli into a conference room. Walsh, Harris's colleague and the lead agent on this case, looks like what you'd want in a career cop. Neutral. He's a block of a man, square and sturdy, no soft spots. You can try as hard as you want to describe him, but you won't get the color of his hair right. It's not blonde, it's not brown, it's not black, it's not straight, it's not thick, it's not thin. His eyes are deep set and earnest. To Walsh, Eli seems unusually cooperative and eager to give a statement. Walsh thinks Eli is cocky, because Eli keeps boasting about how talented he is on computers. Walsh tells Eli he is not under arrest and is free to go whenever he wants. He also reads him his Miranda rights. Eli has the right to remain silent. Anything he says may be used against him. Walsh says that if Eli cooperates, well then, Walsh will let the U.S. attorney know. That could help Eli's case. Eli cooperates. He writes out a 3-page statement. Having started playing and learning about the telephone network at an early age, since about 10 years old, I feel what I know should have been put to good use. Hands-on experience was impossible at age 15. I got my first computer then. I only played with the phone from 10 to 15 years old, so I basically started learning from others interested in learning such as I. being that the telephone network was easily one of the most technically prominent, was probably the reason I chose to learn more about it. I think I should make clear my standpoint on hacking and hackers in general. Hacking to me is more than just hacking out PIN codes, which I do not do. Any idiot can leave his computer running a software program to scan from them all night. Many consider themselves hackers. They post as many as possible or trade them on bulletin boards, BBSs. I particularly do not like this hacker scene, since it misinterprets what hacking really is to me, learning about a system by asking a lot of questions. I knew from the start I would someday work as a computer security consultant or investigator for the telco or government agency. What troubled me the most was, how was I supposed to come out and say, hey, I'm a hacker, I know this and this about your systems, I need a job, without the possibility of being attacked? So I set out to find more about the system by reading documentation and by using the systems. Using PINs was only a bridge to come off a tandem trunk in order to gain entry into the system I wanted to learn more about. I pay for most of my calls and could have had free service had I wanted it, but that would be going against my primary goal, to know and learn. Eli stops writing and hands the confession to his inquisitors, who now include a Bell Corps investigator as well as Walsh. They stand above Eli, and they look very disapproving. I'm done, Eli says. They look it over, and one of them says, this is like an inaugural speech. I don't know what to tell you, Eli says. One of them leaves for a minute and returns with a stack of technical manuals. We already know what you did, so you might as well tell us, he says. Eli is scared. Can I call my mom first? But then Eli agrees to give it another shot. Walsh says to Eli, you know what a switch is, right? Put that in there. They discuss Mizar, Cosmos, LMOS, and Eli helpfully writes out four more pages of detailed explanation that define these acronyms and the extent of which he explored those computers. Eli notes that of all the phone company switches, DMS-100s are my favorites. I set up forwarding lines in order to reach people that were far for me to be called locally. Thereby, I wouldn't have to use another person's PIN. My intentions were not criminal in my eyes. My only intent was to learn. And in the back of my mind, I knew I wanted to work for a telco. Whether RBOC or Interlata, long-distance carrier, I did not care. This is what I know best, and my career was spelled out. If I had had on-hands experience or had been working for a telco, I wouldn't have done what I did. I saw no channel I could use to get a job with them, telephone company, so I applied with a management company in hopes of getting a computer-related job. I was a pioneer in my eyes. Since me and my friends were more advanced than the majority of the hacker population, I learned everything on my own and from friends, but had no criminal intent. I feel it is a waste of my talent when the hackers are viewed, generally, as evil, mischievous people. I was looked up upon by most of the lesser hackers, and I would guide some and help with programming. Not to enter systems, I never posted a dial-up or password to telco systems on any system. Eli goes on to write about all the times he called long-distance carriers and New York Telephone looking for a job, and notes that no one ever returned his calls. He writes that he never meant to do any harm, which I feel sorry for if I have. This is not BS or a cop-out. I just think my side should be told, and I am happy to cooperate. Walsh looks it over, then says, okay, this is better. Walsh shows Eli a sheet of paper on which is written an electronic message that flashed across the screen when the learning link crashed the previous fall. Ha ha, ha ha. Happy Thanksgiving, you turkeys, from all of us at MOD. Eli writes across the sheet of paper, this is a true copy of what I put in the computer. He signs his name. Then Walsh says, just right here at the bottom, that you did this of your own free will. Eli signs his name again. The session is over, and now Walsh brings Eli into a small room in the back of the office where there is a coffee machine and a telephone on the wall. Walsh gets some coffee, and Eli calls his mother to tell her he is okay and will be coming home soon. Eli is so confused. He just wants to get out of here. 9. John Lee dials 0. The hacker leans against a bank of payphones in the atrium of the soaring Citicorp building in downtown Manhattan. He's much too cool to check out his reflection in the plate glass window of the Italian restaurant at the edge of the open space. All around him, teenagers peck at phones like sparrows at a bird feeder, dialing and hanging up, trying random phone numbers. About 50 teenagers are hanging out, swapping information on how to break into computer systems, forming energetic clusters.
Kids dial a number that someone said would connect to a New York telephone switch. The number worked last week. The hackers had materialized out of nowhere around 6 o'clock, just when the office drones fled the Citicorp building for the subway. The kids came here once a month, on the first Friday of the month. No matter the season, they wear beat-up fatigue coats, baggy jeans, clunky-soled shoes, thick, thick black belts with square metal buckles that weigh 5 pounds. They sport peach fuzz mustaches and slick-back buzz cuts. You can't miss them. The gathering is their meeting, and it's organized by the semi-official hacker house organ, a quarterly magazine called 2600 that's published out of Long Island. The magazine's name is an allusion to history. Back in the dark ages of the 1960s, a 2600 hertz tone was used to control all the phone company's trunk lines. Today the tone is obsolete, but the magazine still pays homage to the days when a street-smart hacker named Captain Crunch figured out that blowing a freebie whistle from a cereal box produced the precise tone necessary to make free phone calls. The articles in 2600 tend toward telco technicalities. Every issue sports a photo spread of payphones around the world. Hacker pinups, a payphone kiosk in Belgium, airport payphone in Rome, London phone box. The magazine is eclectic, and so are the meetings held in its name. There's no agenda at a 2600 meeting, no call to order, no parliamentary procedure. It's much more informal than that. The editor of 2600 is Eric Corley, and you can see him today cutting through the crowd, long black curls flying as he passes out copies of the latest issue of the magazine. At 30, Corley is the dean of the Citicorp crowd, a college kid who never left campus, a radical who never mellowed with age. He has a weekly radio show in Manhattan. Tune in on Wednesday nights to hear him on such esoteric topics as how New York Telephone could trace kidnappers' ransom calls more efficiently. And for all intents and purposes, in 1990, Corley represented hackerdom to the rest of the world. He was the unofficial spokesman. Or at least, he was until recently. The Secret Service raids had changed some things. In fact, in the weeks since word of the raids first spread, the 2600 meetings have become much more of a crowd scene. This afternoon, some hackers have traveled from as far away as Syracuse to make the meeting. A few kids cluster by the potted plants, planning an after-hours dumpster dive. We got 30 garbage bags of printouts from the Bank of Tokyo a few months ago. Found 5 passwords, says a chubby high school student wrapped in an army coat. It's quite a scene, and no serious hacker in the New York City area would miss it. Most of the MOD boys are here. They come every month. One time, a dozen MOD boys posed for a group photo. Red Knight, an Indian kid with a penchant for collecting telco manuals, was wearing a sweatshirt that had MOD in big white letters. He stood in the middle of the group, and they all draped their arms around one another. Solidarity. Today, the only MOD member missing is Paul. He's away at college, and he might not be here even if he were home. The raid really scared him, and he's vowed not to hack anymore. Eli and Mark see things differently. They've gone one-on-one with the government and are happy to supply the details to other hackers. Paul has been feeling distance growing between himself and his friends because he's not comfortable with how they behave. He doesn't like to boast. The three of them don't argue about it because that's not Paul's way. He doesn't confront them. He just withdraws, subtly. Paul has never been an easy talker. The joke was you had to know him for months before you got to hear his voice. He'd sit in the background of any social gathering and just listen. Eli and Mark loved to talk, but Paul might not say a word for days. It made some people uneasy, but the fact is, it made Paul blush to even think about talking about himself. Eli and Mark stand at the center of a gaggle of fascinated acolytes near the payphones. How does it feel to be raided by the Secret Service? Hey, were your parents freaked? Eli and Mark have become a walking enlistment poster for hacking. MOD wants you to thwart Uncle Sam. The fear the two had upon walking into their houses and confronting a bunch of armed federal agents has faded. It's been replaced by a certain complacency. They'd been raided, and here they are to tell the story. Never been arrested, never heard back from the Secret Service in the few weeks since the January 24th raids. Although they lost their computers in the raids, MOD was as alive as ever. Eli had seen to that. He even got back to the history of the MOD and updated it. The file was making the rounds among MOD and its closest associates. MOD, MOD, MOD. The History of the MOD. Book 3, A Kick in the Groin. Well, suffice it to say, the fun couldn't last forever. The Secret Service visited the homes of Acid Freak, Fiber Optic, and Scorpion. Days later, they had gone to meet the Wing, which wasn't able to talk for too long since he was too busy. He had been anticipating this little visit for a while, though. His dad didn't exactly like the idea of their presence, and kicked their lack of a warrant asses out before they got a chance to put to use their years of interrogation techniques classes. Seems they think he showed his teacher a credit report or something. The group's popularity soared in such a short period of time, but many hackers disagreed with the MOD style, much in the same way Fiber Optic had enjoyed humiliating those in the know publicly. Seek. Eli also started a chapter called MOD Policy, in which he articulates the group's code of ethics in what he calls the rules. MOD generally frowns upon mischievous stunts that lead to abuse of a system, damaging of a system, or any type of anarchy for no apparent reason other than to be cool. When Paul saw that paragraph, much later, he remembered the Learning Link computer crash. He was amazed at the obvious spin control his friend was putting on the MOD gang's exploits. He felt the same way when he read that MOD no longer stood for Masters of Disaster. Now they were Masters of Deception, according to Eli. Sounds less threatening and certainly less destructive. Masters of Deception. That was a good one. Who was deceiving who? Of course, there was plenty of reason for spin control in those days. In the wake of the raids and the Harper's Forum, the media had discovered MOD in a big way. In fact, the whole hacking scene was making the news. It was a heady feeling, especially for Eli. 6 months ago, he was in the background, just a kid hanging out with friends who knew a lot more about the technical aspects of hacking than he did. Maybe he even felt a little insecure about it. But the Harper's Forum had given him stature. He was a national celebrity now. He was acid freak. Now everybody wanted to hear what Eli had to say. Tonight, in fact, two reporters from Newsday mingle among the adolescents in the atrium's open expanse of ferns and chrome rails and fresh juice joints. The Village Voice is doing a really huge piece about MOD, and Eli has taken that reporter under his wing. Esquire wants to do a primer on how to hack. Geraldo's people are sniffing around, and a screenwriter is even talking to Mark about a movie. Everything is a media event these days, and what the media want to see is some real live hacking. Break into things, they plead. Show us how to social engineer, they beg. Log into the phone company. Create an unbillable phone number. Smile for the camera. To help his friends navigate the unknown, Eli writes in The History of the MOD, mention should be made to all other members of a media event concerning the group in any way. Don't hog the show. The media is a very tricky thing to deal with. They are looking for sensationalism. But wait, aren't Eli and Mark the subject of a major federal investigation? Wasn't thousands of dollars worth of their computer equipment just confiscated? It would make sense to lay low. On the other hand, all the attention is a little overwhelming, and it really doesn't feel like they're in big trouble. Instead, it feels like they just got discovered. John Perry Barlow has even recovered sufficiently from the mesmerizing appearance of his credit history on his computer screen to travel to New York, where he'd met Mark and Eli face to face. Well, actually, he'd been in town on some other business. An NBC producer wanted Barlow to defend the use of LSD on some TV news show segment, since Barlow had been, after all, the one who'd gotten the Grateful Dead to come to Millbrook in 1967 to hang out with Timothy Leary. The NBC producer happened to be dating the Harper's editor, who had put together the Hacker Forum. So somehow, Barlow found himself at dinner with the editor, the producer, and the hackers. They all met at Shun Li, a Manhattan restaurant known not only for its delicious Chinese menu, but also for its 60s sophisticated decor. James Bond meets red-eyed dragons. Mark and Eli were immaculately dressed and on their best behavior when they slid into one of the long, low booths that skirt Shun Li's perimeter. Bravely, they ate jellyfish. Barlow thought he knew exactly who these boys were. He recognized an earlier incarnation of himself. He ordered bourbon and water and slipped the drinks to underage Mark. The boys, although obviously spooked by the recent raids, weren't about to back off from their hacking activities. They said it was a matter of honor. Barlow couldn't help but think of beavers. He used to go to war with beavers on the ranch. They'd get into the irrigation ditches and build dams. As soon as Barlow would blow up one dam, they'd build another, twice as big and a lot uglier. It put those beavers under a lot of pressure to build those dams under those conditions, but they couldn't help it. And here was Mark, a beaver in Barlow's eyes. Mark's turf was blown up by the feds, and he was still coming back for more. The raid only validated his experience, only made hacking more worth the effort. Here was a boy who had lived the better part of the first decades of his life in obscurity, devoted to his obsessive pursuits, who was unknown outside of a tiny circle of enthusiasts. And then, suddenly, one day, he woke up and was famous. He was alive. He was important. He was brilliant. He knew all sorts of things about forbidden computer systems. And he was no longer just a kid filling up the long hours between Star Trek reruns. For the first time in Mark's life, he was somebody. He was a public enemy, worthy of the attention of the government of the United States at the highest levels, not to mention the attention of Harper's Magazine, Esquire Magazine, Good Morning America, and The Village Voice. Soon after that dinner, Barlow returned to Pinedale and felt like a furtive beaver himself. It was a coincidence, maybe, that the FBI cornered Barlow, too, but it was an event that had far-reaching consequences. An FBI agent came to call at the ranch, asking Barlow an afternoon's worth of questions. Someone had stolen the proprietary code embedded in the microprocessors of Apple's Macintosh computers. The code made Macs unique, and now someone was anonymously mailing it around on floppy disks. Even Barlow had gotten one in the mail. Did Barlow mind talking about the theft? How the FBI had gotten Barlow's name was anybody's guess. But the whole experience made Barlow realize how profoundly ignorant the entire federal government was about computers, civil liberties, and the electronic frontier. As he would later write about FBI agent Baxter in a groundbreaking manifesto he called Crime and Puzzlement, "I found in his struggles a framework for understanding a series of recent Secret Service raids on some young hackers I'd met in a Harper's Magazine forum on computers and freedom. And it occurred to me that this might be the beginning of a great paroxysm of governmental confusion, during which everyone's liberty would become at risk." Barlow posted his writings on the Well, where they were read by Lotus 123 creator and Zen millionaire Mitch Kapor. Kapor, who lives in Boston, was struck by Barlow's description of the FBI agent's visit to the ranch because Kapor, coincidentally, had been visited by an East Coast version of Agent Baxter. Kapor was also unnerved at the direction the world seemed to be taking. Obsessive about computers himself, in his youth, Kapor had driven from Boston to New Hampshire to avoid the sales tax that stood between him and his first Mac 2. Kapor empathized with the plight of Fiber Optic, Acid Freak, and Scorpion. One day, Kapor called Barlow from his private jet and asked if he could detour from a scheduled business trip to visit Pinedale. There was a local airstrip, so within hours the two men were hatching a plan for a new group, a national organization that would fight vigorously to protect civil liberties in cyberspace. The group's name would be the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Kapor and Barlow decided that Mark and Eli needed some expert legal advice. With Kapor signing the checks, a meeting was arranged for Mark, Eli, and Paul with a lawyer at the sprawling Manhattan offices of the late Leonard Boudin, who at the time of his death months earlier was among the best-known civil liberties lawyers in the country. Boudin had been the man who'd protected Cuba's U.S. interests for decades and who represented Teamster leader Jimmy Hoffa after his prison release. The boys' meeting there in early 1990 was heady stuff. Subsequently, Kapor paid for Mark and Eli to fly to Boston to tell him their story in person. Mark got queasy on the plane. It was his first flight. No charges had been filed, no lawyers formally retained to defend the MOD boys, but the promise of protection seemed implicit, and protection would be welcome. Who knew how far this nonsense would go otherwise? MOD was not the only hackers group under attack. The government had just raided three LOD hackers in Atlanta. A sting aimed at various hackers across the nation, called Operation Sundevil, was underway, and to the adults at least, the government was overreaching its authority. One man, an adult from Texas named Steve Jackson, was threatened in 1990 with the loss of his business because federal agents had seized his company's computer systems. It seemed they'd been after an LOD guy named The Mentor, an employee of Jackson's company, which created role-playing games in the spirit of Dungeons & Dragons. Jackson, at the time, was working on a fantasy game about computer hackers, which the government apparently believed was a handbook for computer crime. Of course, the government's true agenda was anyone's guess. The government didn't have to tell you what it was up to. One day, agents could show up at your door, hand you a warrant, and take your stuff. Out the door would go the precious computer systems of Steve Jackson Games. And the maddening thing of it was, no one was getting arrested. The government seized this stuff, then sat on it. Jackson would later be vindicated, but that was of no comfort now. The situation resembled a scene from George Orwell's 1984. The times are perilous, but at least hackers are now getting the attention they deserve. With all the excitement, MOD's ranks are growing. One recently inducted member is The Plague, who studies programming at a Manhattan college. The Plague is the scion of Russian emigre parents. He has a light brown ponytail and high cheekbones, a good-looking kid, who looks like Ilya Kuryakin in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The Plague is paranoid. And at today's gathering, He keeps close watch on anyone he suspects might be a government informant. Follow him, the plague hisses to a friend, as a hacker named Long John Silver surreptitiously slips up the stairs to Third Avenue. There's the Seeker, the electronics expert, who loves to build all manner of devices to cheat the phone company. Mark likes to stay overnight at his Manhattan apartment. John Lee is an MOD now, too, and so is his friend, Julio Fernandez, a kid from the Bronx who uses the handle Outlaw. Julio's in the group basically because he's John's friend. John's induction into MOD was only natural because of his intense thirst for computer conquests. All he wants to do is penetrate new systems. He's learned so much about hacking and cracking in the 1 year since he got his modem that he's caught up with the rest of the MOD pack. He'll do anything to get into a new computer. He breaks into a network, then turns over the information to the other MOD members. He's the scout. They chart the territory. On the payphone, John connects to an operator.
Hey, I'm up on a pole here, he says,
using his deepest, most authoritative, most adult voice. It's Super Nigger's signature line and has become standard patter. They all use it now. If only the operator could see John, a tall, 20-year-old black kid in a white t-shirt and khaki pants so baggy they could hold a friend. He doesn't look at all like the part he's playing, a white, middle-aged, tool-belted lineman doing a service check. But he sounds the part, and maybe that's enough. Just maybe the operator will fall for his smooth line of technobabble and give him an open line.
Yeah, I need... Damn.
Disconnected. John hangs up. The hackers are all watching, but not watching, on this drizzly, not quite spring afternoon. It would be lame to pay too much attention. On the other hand, John's stunt is the most interesting thing that has happened.